Welcome back to SOAR Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the HJR mining guy over on X and the CEO of the SOAR Financial Group. Really appreciate you joining us here for another exciting interview today because we have Eric Strand joining us. He's the founder of AUAG Funds, Gold Silver Funds out of Sweden. Really looking forward to this conversation. We had Eric last on at the end of June last year. So we have lots to discuss, lots of topics to chew through because the landscape has changed dramatically. In the interim, we've seen an all-time high in the gold price. And since he is the founder of a gold mining fund, we got to talk gold mining stocks as well. And we got to talk about his allocations in the fund. And one in particular I want to know about is how did he handle the Newcrest and Newmont merger and acquisition? How did he handle it in the portfolio? Because we've discussed that at length here on the channel. So I'm curious how he, as a fund manager, handled that. Now, Eric, it is great to see you again, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us. Happy New Year to you. And thanks so much for making the time.
Yeah, really nice to be back. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we have lots to catch up on, Eric, and lots to discuss. As I said in the intro, our channel likes to discuss the macro to understand the micro. And you're definitely one of the better guests to discuss this with because we can discuss the macro and then we discuss the mining stocks and some of the performance, margin developments and things like that. Let's start at the top, Eric. One question I always like to ask at the beginning is, like, how do you rate the current state of the economy and the financial markets, Eric?
Well, I mean, it has been a game. It's the game of the Fed. I mean, they're talking so much and the market thinks that the rates will come down much faster than the Fed is trying to say. So it's like this game is going on and we see it going this way, that way. And of course, that has effects on the gold price and silver price. This week it goes that way and that way. So I think it's a lot of talking. I don't see many participants really look at what's going on and how much the debt is growing in the US, how much it costs to serve the debt. And of course, I don't believe personally in a soft landing. That means they are lowering rates because the inflation would come down. I think the prices have been going up and are still going up, even if inflation is going down. So the prices are elevated for all the inflation prices that we talk about inflation. And because I think rates will come down because there will be so many troubles in the financial system, and that's when they will really lower rates. So I have another view on it than most normal big banks, maybe, or anybody who's believing in a soft landing.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's like Jerome Powell was fairly clear and dovish in his last speech there in December, where he mentioned, well, we're looking at three rate cuts in 2024. Surprised me a little bit that he was as clear as he was. The market took it and said, okay, he said three, let's make it six or seven even. And I think some predictions had eight rate cuts next year. But at eight rate cuts, that must be a massive like a disaster in the markets, because that looks like a Gulf War recession that we've had, the dot-com bubble, similar scenarios. Do you see the similar scenario developing next year, Eric?
Well, what is interesting that is like everybody wants to see lower rates, and we need lower rates probably in the system. But I mean, the reason for the lowering of the rates are different. As I said, the Fed, they think they will do it because they have controlled the inflation rate. But I don't think that would be the reason in the end. So as we have seen in history, there are no such things as soft landings, really. And we have also seen that they normally lower rates much faster than they raise them. So, of course, the Fed, talk is cheap. So, of course, they want to say higher for longer or transitory. I mean, they want to use these words. Sometimes you're surprised that the market really believe them. And that's what we have seen in the gold price. When the market really believed in a pivot, the gold price was really flying, making new all-time highs. And of course, then the Fed was out again saying, no, we will not. Came a headwind for gold. So it's this back and forth, but not really based in what is happening in the world, but more based on just on what they are saying from one point to another.
Yeah, I think inflation is an interesting topic. And one topic I picked up just reading the news the last few days here as well is inflation fears and worries about creeping up inflation again as well, because we've seen higher inflation in the US, higher inflation also in Europe. So are we returning to higher inflation scenarios? Is maybe even a potential rate hike back on the table?
I would rather say that they would have to give up on inflation. So they cannot keep what they really want, because first of all, the prices are elevated. I mean, to get the prices back where we had them 2 or 3 years ago or something similar like that, they would have to have a really high interest rates to get there, and we won't get there. So the prices will stay high even if the inflation rate is getting lower. But as you said, I think what is really driving inflation are strong forces that we cannot really change, and that is we have had production prices going down for 30, 40 years, moving labor to the Asia East, and now we also see even the deglobalization, and these are very strong forces. We also see a larger middle class in India, China, with more buying power, and of course they will compete on the same thing. So I think we will have inflation, and we will have to live with inflation. And on the other hand, the system wants inflation because they want us to consume. I mean, is it like 70% of the GDP in US is consumption? And if you don't have inflation, you don't get the buyers to buy now. And that's what you want. You want them to buy now, because so inflation is really like, I wouldn't say funny, because it's really a terrible thing, but it's something they want. And sometimes they say they want to make it lower, or it's their target to have it at 2%. And so I think it's just I wouldn't say a game, but they talk a lot.
Oh, absolutely. And how do you figure out geopolitical tensions into all of that? Now we're looking at the Red Sea being under fire, more or less. That could cause some concerns. The oil price is not really reflecting it just yet. It's fairly stable. But how do you see that factoring in?
Well, things are happening, and it's very insecure, and you have to. That's why you get the deglobalization. You want to secure, like, mining critical metals. You have to mine them in Europe or in the US. That won't be cheaper, maybe safer, but it will become more expensive. So there are a lot of things that will make a case for stronger or higher prices in the future. And instability in the world is very much such a thing. And we will see, I think we will see more of that. Terrifying, of course, to see how it, what is happening and what can happen. I mean, it's like also China, Taiwan. I mean, I hope nothing happens there, but if it is going to happen, I mean, there's a good, now when the US is so preoccupied, I don't know if there would be a better timing for China to move. So I think that's a little bit scary. That I know so much about that, but just looking at the situation, the risk is there that we will see more of instability and unfortunately wars. And the strange thing here is that we have wars, people die and we destroy a lot of buildings or whatever, and then of course they are rebuilt, and that was, we look like a GDP going up. Because, I mean, you have to spend money to build things, but you have never built. I mean, you destroyed something, and you build a new house. You really didn't create something. And I think that's the problem, that we don't have a good GDP growth. It's just like debt-based. It doesn't really bring new roads or new houses or so on. It's like for not so good things. And I think people have to start to measure good loans, good debt, bad debt, or good growth. Not just looking at the number and then make a Fed decision on whatever number, but to see it more holistic or what's really, really happening.
Absolutely. Like, you know, where do you see some headwinds for the markets in 2024 there, Eric? You mentioned, you know, the GDP growth, and that always brings me to thinking about AI as well, and increase in productivity. And then again, I mentioned earlier the dot-com boom. I think I mentioned before recording as well, like just talking about Fed rate cuts during that time as well. So talking about GDP growth, headwinds for 2024, like how does that all fit together? How do you predict the market to develop there in 2024, Eric?
I mean, it's, GDP growth is one thing, and of course AI, I don't think that will really give us growth. I mean, it will make it easier for maybe some companies to have less people employed, and that's another problem. So, and we also see that things don't really get cheaper because we have more high tech. I mean, the iPhone isn't cheaper today than it was before. So somehow we succeed to like consume the high tech. So if you look at history, it never really got cheaper because maybe TVs got cheaper. But then we are very good at finding new things, and we spend more money. So some companies, of course, if they don't need so many employees, that will save some money. But that would be a problem for the state with unemployment because we don't create more jobs. So I don't know. I don't think there's so much to win. It's very, for me, overhyped. It's very nice with the evolution. And for me, it's like, I mean, we had the calculator, so it was really fast with numbers. And now we have the AI, like it's really fast with words and sentences. So it's new tech, but I don't think it will grow us out of something really.
No, one discussion. I don't want to take it down that rabbit hole, but I had a guest on who discussed universal basic income as a result of the AI revolution, just so that social inequality is more or balanced, right? So, just random side note there.
I'm not in that camp.
Yeah, I have a hard time with it personally as well. So just I work, and I want to see the benefits of that personally. So, a couple more topics I want to talk about before we talk about the miners and how they have developed is the bond market and the US dollar. Let's start with the bond market. We've seen a bit of a rally in bond prices and yields coming down, but that has reversed in recent weeks. Surprisingly, at the beginning of the year, the trend completely reversed as well. We're back at roughly 4% for the 10-year. How do you see the bond market developing as well? Because it seems to be an interesting indicator, a contraindicator for the gold market.
Well, it can be, and there is some, of course, some competition from the bond market or money market. So, and I think we mean with lower rates, bonds can be an interesting investment. But the trend is that we always go lower and lower in rates. And I mean, we have been even zero. I think we will go back somewhere close to 1% again. And then it will not be so interesting to hold bonds. But for a while, it can be interesting, of course, maybe the coming year. But I'm not the expert on the bond market, actually. I mean, it's such a strong, big market, or big market at least. I'm more worried maybe about the financing for companies that will have to pay higher rates and how they will do. And I'm interested to see how that works out in the US. I mean, they have company debt ever, I would say, and that has always ended in some trouble.
Absolutely. Now, I think last time we talked, Eric, was about just when the yield curve reinverted again. We've seen some positive real yields again being created. So we're the bond yields were higher than inflation. So, and we're in that real yield territory again, right around 4%. With if you want to believe the actual inflation number that's being presented to us, around 3.2 or 3.4% or so.
I think that's where it all starts. That number. What is that number?
Exactly. What do you factor in, and do you believe that we've beaten inflation as well? Right. So, I can't say that without smiling. It's tough to keep a straight face talking about that inflation number, that we've beat inflation as well. Yeah. So, one last thing, Eric, I want to talk about is the U.S. dollar, because you mentioned it in a recent update as well, giving a bit of an outlook for the U.S. dollar in 2024. Let's break down the U.S. dollar. How do you see the currency developing next year, or this year actually?
Well, first of all, I must say, I mean, the U.S. dollar is still the reserve currency and the strongest in the room in one way. I mean, if you get turbulence in the market, investors will always go for the dollar instead of smaller currencies. So it's still the biggest, largest one, and it has some strength in there. But there are two things that will be a headwind for the dollar. And one is actually the de-dollarization in the world. I mean, it's still the mostly used dollar, but we see more and more countries trying to start to make trades without the dollar. And we see more and more political positioning against the dollar. So there has been a premium for the dollar being the world reserve currency, and I think that premium will come down. So there is a reason why the dollar should become softer. And then there is the reason that the dollar always goes up first, as Fed is normally the central bank that raises rates first. And then you have a strong period with a strong dollar. And now we are getting to the opposite side, where they're going to lower rates, and probably the Fed will lead again. And that will create a headwind for the dollar and make it softer. I think there are two reasons that for a European investor, you have to think in a little bit different way than you did 3 years ago or 2 years ago. So, and I think that's interesting, especially for investing in miners, for European investors, actually.
That's a very good point. Hold on, I'm going to come back here on the screen. That's a very good point, because one thing you mentioned is the FX advantage being for us being in Europe. How do you factor that in? Like, how does that explain that to us? Break that down a little bit. What's the advantage there?
I would like to try to do that in an easy way. But sometimes, I mean, we have investments in gold with an ETF or ETC in Europe, or you have the miners. And of course, there has been a competition that we didn't see 20 years ago. I mean, all gold investments were in miners. And then the last 10 years, some money have left the miners for pure gold ETFs or ETCs investments. And but what happens here is that this leverage that normally miners have for the gold price happens before the FX effect. And my simple or easy example is, if we will get a 20% return on gold this year, and we have a 2x leverage for miners, that would get us 40%. I mean, it's an example for mathematics. So that's it. But then if the dollar loses 10% via the euro or pound or whatever, the net effect for a European investor in gold would be 10%. But the net effect for the mining investment would be 40 minus 10%, 30%. And suddenly you have the relation 10 to 30 for the European investor. But in the US, it's still 20 and 40, 2-to-1. So for a European investor, it gets more interesting to miners this period when the rates are going down and the dollar will be softer.
It's the so-called double whammy, to quote Anchorman. So
it's against the miners in a rate hike cycle compared to gold, but it will become an advantage to be invested in miners instead of the commodity.
Absolutely. Before we talk miners, quickly, I want to talk on the gold price, so we can have a solid foundation to discuss the miners. At the end of the year, we've seen the gold price spike tremendously. We touched on $2,100, a new all-time high. Didn't see a lot of follow through in the buying, unfortunately. Everybody expected a bit of a rally, come breaking through that ceiling. It hasn't happened. Let's discuss that real quick, Eric. Like, what pushed the gold price higher first, and then, of course, why didn't we see a follow through?
Well, I mean, the market really believes now in the pivot, and of course that will make gold higher, especially when it really starts. And we really want to believe it. Everybody wants to believe it. Now, of course, there was some sort of short squeeze, and we got this very, very high spike there overnight. Then it came back, because I think the Fed was really fast out saying that the market misunderstood their, that they were not going to lower rates that fast. But I'm also happy that it seems like now 2000 is not the question anymore. I mean, we have stayed over 2000 for a long time, very stable. So not really coming, because we had this period that we were over 2000 and then down again and then over and then down. And we have actually stayed over 2000 for a long time, and for me, I think 2100, if we can stay there over a time, then we really get the speed up and we will never look back again.
Absolutely. What are the most important factors influencing the gold price right now? Because just over the weekend, unfortunately, we've seen a bit of a spike in the gold price again due to geopolitical tensions in Yemen. The U.S. bombing Houthi positions gave a bit of a spark to the gold price. How sustainable is that?
I'd say these spikes are never sustainable, because they always come down again. So it's short-term protection in a portfolio, yes, for the total portfolio. But come back to where they were. So that doesn't really help gold prices in the long run. I mean, gold prices are a mirror of the money creation and debt creation in the financial system. And that's a long-term trend that I probably won't disappear during our lives, because they just create more debt and more money. We see the debt in the US just... such big deficits. So there are so many strong fundamentals for gold, and especially when we get a softer dollar, making gold cheaper for Asian investors. I think we get a lot of buying power there, and that would take the price up. And of course, we have a very low sentiment in the market for gold or gold miners. And when that changes, I mean, you open all the gates. People start to hunt the price, and I think that will come later because we have been in a depressed market in some ways. So it will take time. And of course, that's good for any investor that wants to accumulate. It's an opportunity. I think we're this is an opportunity situation.
Absolutely. No, and I was going to ask you sort of the follow-up question here based on the performance of the gold price, like not just your fund, but how have the miners developed? Let's talk about the performance a little bit, because talk about a time lag. We haven't seen much performance development. Let's talk about that a bit. Like, of course, the share price has jumped a little bit, but I wouldn't even call it a jump. Maybe skipped a little bit. I don't know how to say it. Maybe you could break that down for us. Like, how did the miners react to everything?
I'm a little bit, of course, surprised in one way, but I think the sentiment is really, really low. What is interesting me more is is there anybody left who wants to sell? Who is selling in the market? I don't understand who is selling, because I mean, it looks like it's almost stupid to sell in the market. And of course, for every buyer, there must be a seller, or the opposite. So it's very interesting who is buying and who is selling. So I really think we're getting into strong hands, and I think that's very, very good for the future, that more and more gold and gold miners.
No, absolutely, Eric. One trend. Go ahead. Sorry, I think you.
No. For a second. No, but as you said, it's a big lag, and I think there's a misconception that the market maybe have not understand that the miners have changed their behavior. I mean, in 2000 or so on, we had the hedging. That was such a big mistake for the big companies. They don't do that again. Then you have on the 2011 all-time high, they were doing a lot of exploration, spending a lot of money in not such a good ways. They created more or took on more debt and so on. Not very good. But all this has changed. I mean, the miners have become so more, much more share owner friendly. I mean, they have lowered the debt. I mean, all other sectors have taken on more debt, and the miners have lowered their debt. And we have a very stable gold price, even if it goes up and down a little bit, but it is very stable and high. Costs have gone up for the miners with the energy and so on, but that has been coming down, I would say, the energy prices. So they're starting to pay dividends, they do buybacks, and they don't do buybacks in the wrong way, like a lot of other companies have done on the top of share prices, but on lower prices and without creating more debt. It's a totally different world today, but I think the market hasn't really seen that or not really interested, because you can get money just investing in any.
Now, I think one big topic was always margin compression. For the miners, you mentioned it, costs crept up, so everybody started selling off the miners when they saw margins start to shrink. That was especially in the early phase of the run-up to $2,000. The question is now, how have the margins developed and in recent quarters? Personally, I don't follow the big miners too closely. Of course, I take a glance at the numbers of the Barricks and the Newmonts, but I don't track it. So I'm curious, how have the margins developed in recent quarters?
I mean, that it looks really, really strong just because of this stable price. It's not going up and down so much. I think they have very strong cash flows, but I don't think the market's really, really interested, or they don't see maybe the higher gold price. I don't see the costs going up for them. So I think they will have fantastic results coming over the years. The problem I may see in the market for miners is the jurisdiction. That's the where I worry. Mostly political and jurisdiction questions. Cash flows, money, profits, buybacks, take M&As. Everything looks really, really good. Debt situation. Everything looks really, really good for me. But political and jurisdictional questions, that's where I worry.
Since you brought that up, quick follow-up question there, Eric. What jurisdictions do worry you? We've recently seen some political turmoil in Ecuador, for example, just before the weekend. So I'm curious, what kind of jurisdiction is iffy for you?
Well, for us, I mean, since we started 2019, jurisdiction has been very high on our list. In the beginning, we said we don't invest in Chinese companies. I mean, mining in China with the Chinese management or ownership, or very difficult countries in Africa. And we decided at that time not to invest in Russian companies because it was like a one-man show. And there was some good decision to make 2019. And we don't want countries with too low transparency indexes because that shows that it's a state that is very something can happen because when you run a fund, you don't want to have this binary risk that something really, really happens, like a coup or something. Unfortunately, this question become much larger now because we see problems in, well, let's say South America, Mexico. We have seen more and more things happening in these questions, and sometimes they are hard to understand. Sometimes the state wants to make something, but it looks bad from the beginning, but in the end, maybe it's not that bad for our companies because it gets more regulated or they get more deals from that. So I think the computers, they see the news of something and they sell the stocks short or whatever. And then when you read a little bit more about it and understand it, it's maybe not that bad as it looked on the first line in the news. So a lot of misunderstandings, but still things are happening. And it's very important that the miners are good at handling the situations. I mean, we had the Panama situation. We see more situations, and it was very important for us 2019 to set our baseline for jurisdiction. But it's becoming more and more important, and it's a hard one to really, where do you draw the line?
Absolutely, because Ecuador, Peru, Chile are really favorable mining jurisdictions on paper, but then we see things happening like in Ecuador over the weekend, and you just wonder, is this where I want to put my money? Right?
Yeah,
So,
it's a good questions and important questions to handle.
absolutely. Let's talk about consolidation. You mentioned that the companies are set up for it now. Balance sheets are clean, and we've seen quite a bit of consolidation towards the end of the year. The biggest one, obviously, was Newmont buying Newcrest for roughly $20 billion. I think it was 19.2 or so. Don't quote me on the exact number. But how do you see consolidation developing in the sector now, especially in 2024 going forward?
I think it's for as an investor, it's a good sign that it's happening. And I would say not unfortunate, but I think we have very often been on both sides. So we haven't got the premium really. I mean, you want to own the company that is bought, but you get that premium. But we see it and we see more. And I think that's the reason behind it is that they have strong cash flow, they have good economics, low debt, and they don't want to start new exploration. And they don't want to do the unsafe thing, so they rather buy another, maybe a little bit smaller or still rather large peer in the group. So I think that will continue. Sometimes I like it because we get a premium if our holding is bought by another somebody else. But I don't really like when the universe gets too small either. So it's like I have sometimes it's good. Sometimes I'm not so happy to see that we get fewer and fewer miners to choose from. So it's like I have
Absolutely.
both sides.
I get it, especially in the silver space, it's quite cramped. There's not a lot of opportunity there in the silver space, I think.
Yeah, and the gold space. And I think I mean in the silver when the silver price is the gold to silver ratio is so high and we have to see that come down from anything like 85, you have to sit down, come 70, and then I think it gets really, really interesting, because if we get a 20% gold return this year, I think it's very realistic in dollars. And then we get the gold to silver ratio go from 85 to 70, we would see a silver price on 35, and that would be a 48% return. And then it would become more interesting to see how these miners, how much, I mean, when you see how much silver do they mine, it's on revenue. And when the gold to silver ratio is very high, I mean, it doesn't look like they mine so much silver, because the revenue is not so high because the price is so low on silver. So when the prices come up in silver and starts to really go, I think, I mean, the revenue from silver will be higher as a percentage of these companies, and it will get more interesting, of course, for them to try to mine more, find more silver. But and I think silver will be really explosive.
So since we're on the topic of silver, Eric, a question that can be quite controversial. Do you see silver as a precious metal still, or more of an industrial metal?
I think it's a unique metal that it's both. I mean, it's the one that is both. And I think that's a very strong for an investor, because when you get a physical shortage for the industry and you use silver in like everything, every camera, every computer, every car, sun cells, everywhere you need silver, but it's so little silver, so the price is inelastic. So the car companies, they will buy the silver for whatever price, because it will not change the price of the end product. So for them, it doesn't really matter if the price is 25 or 100, it doesn't really change, and they need it for the car. And it's only 40 grams or 50 grams in the car, but they need it. And we get this physical shortage, and we're really looking that there are no reserves anymore that can be bought, that is not owned by other investors, and they will not sell now. And when we have had this managed price to too low price, you actually create this situation, because nobody has the real incentives to try to mine enough silver. So I think something big will happen in silver. I've been thinking that for a long time, of course, but I mean, it gets closer by every day. That's a mathematical fact. And if you look at the numbers, how tight it is, how they have to ship silver in and out just to make it work. And when the rumors get that we have not premiums on retail buying silver coins, I mean, that solves itself by these premiums, but in the industry, never happening in gold. And of course, on the other side, if you have copper, it's only industrial. So I think silver is the perfect.
The perfect metal. Fantastic. Eric, one thing like I wanted to talk to you about, like we talked about Newmont and Newcrest, and I want to circle back to that real quick, because I've been talking about it in presentations and other interviews as well personally, where I was like, okay, if a fund manager owns, let's say, 5% in his portfolio of Newmont and 5% of Newcrest, and we see that mega merger happen, I think you weighted them at 4% each, I think, in the past. So let's assume you go to 8% of the new Newmont. How do you deal with that situation, and how does that play out? My question hints sort of at the flow of funds. Where is the money flowing afterwards, and how did you handle that situation, Eric?
Well, it's a bit different. I mean, we have one ETF, the gold mining ETF, that has been growing a lot lately. Very good. And there is, I mean, it's an AI, I would say, because it's a computer system. Mm-hmm. I mean, you write the rules, and they are written in stone, so you have to follow the rules. And when one company disappears, like Newcrest, and it was in the portfolio, we have to add a new one. And so that doesn't happen during, that happens during the rebalancing phase. And we have a, what we call a smart rebalancing or Asian rebalancing, so we rebalance over 4 days. So we actually buy Alan buy, but that's automatically, we cannot do anything about that. It's not like it's not an active fund, it's an ETF. So that's easy. It doesn't matter what we think, it just happens. We have to put in a new holding, because we want to have 25 holdings equal weighted to be in a better, have a better fund construction for returns than the big ones in the ETF market. And I think equal weighting is much better than market weighted in that situation. or any situation in the coming secular bull market.
So who replaced Newcrest in the fund, Eric?
Well, it's hard to say, actually, because we had two additions and two deletions. And because we want to have the companies with the also good ESG risk scores that they are doing miners and to exclude the bad miners. And so the new companies actually was very, very funny because Barrick, or not funny, but Barrick was not one of the 25 best companies regarding of ESG. But now they are in the our ETF at 4%, but still that's much lower than the other ETFs having Barrick. And also Majestic are one of the 25 best ESG ranked companies now in the world.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. Don't want to jump down that rabbit hole, but it's an interesting tidbit. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. You mentioned you've seen inflows into the funds, and it's one comment I wrote down as well, because I think you posted about it on X as well. So I'm curious, where is the money coming from, Eric? And like, who are the investors? Like, I don't want any names, but I'm just more interested in the profile, because as you said before, like, there's a bit of a general lag of interest still with the generalists.
Yes, I mean, we have in our actively managed funds in the Nordics and north of Europe, we have 40,000 retail investors, so we have a big base for that already. But also with our ETF, we have, I mean, we are available all over Europe on all the big exchanges, so that's good. And also that we have seen this big that's really, really nice to see institutions, pension institutions, buying into the story of owning gold miners. And of course, they're happy with the construction of the ETF, that it's smart, that it's regarding the equal weighting and questions, so they don't own the bad ones that you get in a market weighted or ETF where you get all companies.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's rare that you see pension funds coming back into the market, especially in North America. Pension funds have left the gold mining space or the mining space in general. Yeah,
well, now we're talking about Europe, right?
Now it's Europe. I know. So that's why it's like I'm surprised. It's great to hear. So
I think, I mean, if you, the problem maybe with some institutional investors is that, I mean, they have a political risk. They don't want to make mistakes. They want to keep their job. And then it's very easy to do what everybody else is doing, because then you never do anything wrong. But if you start to look, where is the opportunity in the market? I mean, where can you buy something very, very cheap with, I mean, it's a volatile market, of course, but still, I mean, downside is limited, I would say, but the upside is you have very good return situation to go for the miners. And one day we will see the rotation. I mean, we see big risk with this very few companies being such a big part of the all the other indexes. So I think, but yeah, of course, you have to be very strong asset managers to start to buy into gold miners as if you're a pension fund, because you're doing something different. And of course, many of them may not want to take that risk because they want to have the same return like everybody else. And then you better follow everybody else. One day they will start to think, and I think these there will be winners with the asset opportunity. They will get back to this real investment style and not just following. That's not making any mistakes, but that they start to trust themselves and do a real good job and buying cheap. I think that's we have to wait for it, but it's good to see that it starts to happen.
Absolutely. No, it's been a massive lack in the or missing in the sector as well, because it's a big contributor, of course, of capital. Eric, one very last question to sort of, I wouldn't say sum up the conversation, but maybe taking it completely off topic here. Is uranium a green metal for you? We just jumped over $100 a pound.
Uranium. I was so lucky, actually. I mean, it was not very easy year 2023, but the media, they asked like 15 managers in Sweden, they had to choose one company for 2023. And on average, of course, we were on the minus side, but for that like a media competition, I chose one company in our essential metals fund, where it's a broad metal fund, and I chose Cameco. So that was my bet for 2023 in this competition between asset managers. and it gave me a good place with almost 100. Yes, we have one fund where we invest in uranium companies. One way I like the story, and there is a risk in the story, that is, like, if we would have a total, I mean, we see all the, everybody wants more nuclear, or it has a good run now for more nuclear plants, and but there is a big risk, and that is, like, would we have the accident in Ukraine? I mean, one day or 1 hour or 1 minute, it would, like, so it's a, you have a big binary risk if something happens there. I think, like, a dead thing suddenly. So it's and we see it's very, very expensive to start these new plants. We see that in Sweden, where they're going to start new plants and so on, but it takes time, and there is not enough people, because you have to be very well trained to run these things. So, but I think it's very interesting. I would have liked to see thorium reactors much earlier also, but I think Germany should go for that. But if they don't want uranium, they should go for thorium reactors that cannot have these accidents. So money for it. So I think that would be good. Then, of course, it's very difficult to invest in these companies, because for us, they are not liquid enough. They're not tradable. I mean, you have Cameco, and you can think whatever you want about Cameco, but I mean, the coming companies are maybe some interesting explorers, NextGen or something like that. But and then you see an ETF on uranium companies, and I don't understand how it really works. I mean, it's buying maybe works.
Companies in it.
Yeah, no, it's more, but I mean, and I don't, I mean, they are not, we don't see them as tradable on the stock exchange. And there is a trouble if there will be a downturn, which is not just going up in a straight line, when people start to sell in these ETFs, and you have underlying companies that are very illiquid. I think that can become a problem in that market. And I would like to see more companies that you can really trade. That would be interesting.
Absolutely. I'm headed to Vancouver actually later this week for the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. Now that we're talking, I'm curious how many uranium exploration companies will be there that haven't existed. Yeah,
I would like to add one into our essential metals fund, but I need it to be tradable. I mean, there are some that are tradable, but still they are explorers, so you don't really know. Is the story, how good is the story in reality? They start to make money. I would prefer if they've made some money as well.
Absolutely.
It's fantastic. Very, very interesting.
Eric, wonderful conversation. Let's wrap it up here. You said 2475 for gold, 35 for silver by the end of the year. Where can we find more of your work, Eric? I think I've shown the website. Where can we follow you?
Yeah, you got the website there. You can also follow us, get our monthly letters in English if you want that. So sign up for that.
Fantastic. Absolutely. No, we'll do that. And Eric, thanks so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Can't wait to have you back, and stay on for a second. I got to ask you something. So stay on for a second. Everybody else, really appreciate you tuning in. Thanks so much for watching this episode of SOAR Financially. If you haven't done so, here's a reminder. Subscribe and like this video. Highly appreciate it. Thanks so much for joining us. We're over 26,000 subscribers. It means a lot to me. It means that we can bring guests like Eric on this channel. We'll have other great guests joining us this week. Peter Schiff, Gary Wagner of thegoldforecast.com as well. So make sure to subscribe and like, and maybe hit that bell icon as well, so you get a notification when we publish a new video. As I mentioned, I'm off to Vancouver later this week. I'm going to present at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. I just ended in my title for the presentation, Mining 101, Capitalizing on the Gold's New All-Time High. But let's discuss that. And I hope to see some of you in Vancouver next week as well. Thanks so much for tuning in. Subscribe and like. We'll be back with lots more.